Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. Last week, I think it was last Thursday, April the 9th, we had a discussion here in our ongoing series called What's Going On after the great Marvin Gaye hit, and we try to look at what's going on in the world. And as we prepared for that show, I ran across an article in commondreams.org, at commondreams.org, the website, that originally appeared in Yes magazine. It had been written by Ellen Brown, and Ellen Brown is a lawyer who wrote the article originally in April 2009 for A Path to a New Economy. She's written a great deal about the question of debt. Her website, by the way, is webofdebt.com and ellenbrown.com, which you can go to as we're speaking. This article really grabbed me, and we wrestled with it all hour, most of the hour, and what she was trying to say in this article, and decided it was time to let her do it in person because it's an idea that we hear very little about, but one maybe the nation should be wrestling with. And Ellen Brown, welcome. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you.
You all can join us here at 410-319-8888 to join in on this discussion with Ellen Brown. And Ellen, I even love the way you began the article itself. I don't know if you want to read this or I should read it. Your introduction to your letter to President Barack Obama?
You'd best. I don't have it in front of me.
I'd be glad to. Be happy to. I just want to get
a wonderful voice.
Pardon?
You also have a wonderful voice.
Thank you. Let me kind of begin this. Our listeners can get a sense of where you're taking us. It's called Revive Lincoln's Monetary Policy, an Open Letter to President Obama. Dear President Obama, the world was transfixed on that remarkable day in January when, to poetry, song, and dance, you gazed upon Abraham Lincoln's likeness at the Lincoln Memorial and searched for wisdom to navigate these difficult times. Indeed, you have so many things in common with that venerable president that one might imagine you were his reincarnation in different dress. You're both thin and wiry, brilliant speakers appearing on the national stage at pivotal times. Fertile imaginations could envision you coming back triumphantly as one of those slaves you freed to prove once and for all the proposition that all men are created equal and can achieve great things if given a fighting chance. But as Wordsworth said, our birth is but a deep sleep and forgetting. And if that is true, you may have forgotten a more subtle form of slavery from which Lincoln freed his countrymen, even if you were there at that time. You may have forgotten it because it's been omitted from the history books, leaving Americans ill-equipped to interpret the lessons from our own past. This letter is therefore meant to remind you. We are now met on another battlefield of the same economic war that visited Lincoln and the founding fathers before him. President Obama, the fate of our economy and nation itself may depend on how well you understand Lincoln's monetary breakthrough, the most far-reaching economic stimulus plan ever implemented by a U.S. president. You can solve our economic crisis quickly and permanently by implementing the same economic solution that allowed Lincoln to win the Civil War and to save the Union from foreign economic masters. Well, I can't read the whole article on air. I'd like to, but I'll let you do that in terms of explaining it to us. This is an amazing idea that I never even thought about nor realized when you said Lincoln was faced with the war, how to raise money for this war, turning to the banks who were going to charge him 24% to 36% interest. And then Colonel Dick Taylor from Illinois reports back to him that Congress is allowed by the Constitution to print full legal tender Treasury notes. Let's talk about what you're saying here. I'm just amazed that our government can do something that it's not doing.
Most people think the government does create money, and they blame the government for things that go wrong. But in fact, all of our money is created privately by banks in the form of loans. Federal Reserve notes are created by the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation, which then lends those green pieces of paper that we call dollars, lends them to the U.S. government. What the U.S. government prints are pink pieces of paper called bonds or debt. So we are delivering our debt in exchange for something that's merely created on a printing press by a private banking corporation, the head of the private banking system. It wasn't too bad when everything was humming along smoothly, but now it's obvious that things are falling apart and there's some fundamental problem in our banking system. And that's where the flaw is, that what people think is happening is not what's really happening. So what the solution would be to go back to what people think we have. In other words, the banks only lend other people's money. They don't create money on their books, and that money is created by the government. That was the system we had in the 18th century. The American colonists printed their own money. So that's what Lincoln did. He went back to that system of the American colonists briefly, and then, of course, he was assassinated, and it all went the other way again.
Well, I want to get back to what he did in printing these greenbacks and why it went back the other way again. But I want to understand what you're saying is what President Lincoln did was actually not take what was known as our legal tender then, which were the banks printing their own notes individually, backed by gold. But what Lincoln did was to create an American tender, American money, that we ended up calling greenbacks, which is what we still call them, and that he then fueled the not only the Civil War by that, but a good portion of the new steel industry, building the railroad, and other economic growth and engines in this country. Is that what you're positing?
Right. That's how he funded development, and that's how development should be funded, basically with credit. You write your project up on one side of your books and the money that it takes to build it on the other side, and then you draw from that account, build the thing, and then you pay off the loan with the proceeds of the thing you built. But instead, what we do is we do that, but we borrow from a bank that didn't really have the money. They write it on their books and pretend they had the money. They lend it to us, and then we owe the money back with interest. And the reason it's now all messed up is because the banks have messed up their books and don't have the capital. I mean, that's a long other story. But the point is, we don't need those banks. The government could set up its own public banking system. The ideal system was actually in Pennsylvania in the 18th century. Pennsylvania had its own provincial bank. So the government printed money, lent it through this bank to the farmers, then the money all came back, so it wasn't inflationary. It came back as principal and interest on loans, so the interest was sufficient to fund the government, and they didn't pay taxes at all.
They didn't pay taxes?
No, the interest was enough to replace taxes. They didn't have inflation, and the government never went into debt.
But one of the arguments we hear, though, is that, and I want to get into the kind of the dilemma we're facing in America now and how this particular idea would change, could change the nature of the debate in terms of how we're funneling money into banks and into Wall Street at the moment by the hundreds of billions of dollars. But the question I have is then people look at banks. Banks loan us money. Banks are supposed to have cash or something in that and financial reserves to back up the money they loan us that we have to pay back.
That's the catch is they don't. They don't have the backup money. When we used to be on a gold standard, it was called fractional reserve lending, and banks had quickly figured out that they only had to keep about 10% of the gold that they had. In other words, they would lend 10 times as many notes as they had gold. So 9 out of 10 notes were counterfeit, because people only came for their gold 10% of the time on average. But periodically, people would get suspicious, and they would all come for their money at once, and that would be known as a bank run, and the bank wouldn't have the money, and they'd have to close their doors. So we've been keeping up that fraud ever since, that banks actually have something to lend. They're allowed to lend many times what they have on reserve, and of course what they have on reserve now originates as a debt of the U.S. government. So there's really nothing backing it at all. It's all created on paper.
So what would back an American? Let's say that Barack Obama decided that, and we'll come to how the Federal Reserve Bank was started in a moment, but that created another Bank of America. Oh, that can't use that term because that's already taken. But created some new federal bank and printed notes.
Mm-hmm.
What would back that? I mean, how would it ameliorate the situation we're in, and how would that money be backed?
Well, you needn't back it by anything, or if you want to follow the fractional reserve system or the Bank for International Settlements capital requirement, which is actually what limits bank lending right now, you would take the BIS capital requirement is 8%. So if you have $8 of real money, you're allowed to lend $100. So let's say Obama started his own bank, or let's say he started at the Reconstruction Finance Corporation, which is what Roosevelt used to fund the 1930s economic development. That was a government-owned lending facility. So let's say Obama started that up again, but what Roosevelt did was he borrowed the money first. So let's say...
He borrowed it from banks.
Yeah, so it was a debt-based system, and it didn't really create anything, and it put us more in debt. That was the problem with that system. But what Obama could do is take that $800 billion that Congress has already approved for a stimulus package, put that in a bank, and now on with an 8% reserve requirement, you've got something like $9 trillion, or at least $8 trillion, to lend. So you've got $8 trillion in credit that you could, with $8 trillion, you could save the whole mortgage crisis. You could save Social Security. I mean, there's an amazing number of things you could do, and you're just doing it on credit.
So we're talking, by the way, at this moment here on the Mark Steiner Show with Ellen Brown, whose article is in Yes Magazine that I found on commondreams.org. You can go to her website as well, Web of Debt, or ellenbrown.com.org, and see what she's been writing and what we're talking about here, which is a way of thinking that we're not thinking about, and maybe some ways we need to, if we can understand this, and we're trying to understand this, because next time we have our congressmen and senators on here, maybe we can ask them about this very specifically and create a conversation that no one seems to be having about the future of American debt and the future of American money. So when Abraham Lincoln did this, and let's go back to why this worked during the Civil War and why it stopped working. What is that story?
Okay. It worked because we didn't have money before that. I mean, the North was in debt, and the bankers were trying to trap the North into debt. That was the whole idea, was to there's actually writings to that effect, that the idea was to recolonize the country economically. They had lost the colonies physically or politically, but they would get them back basically as servants, you know, or in a form of bondage, an economic form of bondage by debt. The same thing that you see going on around the world with all these loans to third world countries that they now can't afford to pay back, development loans and so forth. So Lincoln just resisted that and instead printed his own money. So basically what he was printing were receipts for goods and services delivered to the government. So he paid the soldiers with these little green paper that they were first called greenbacks because they were green on one side, and then we still call them greenbacks. So they were called U.S. notes. And he paid the suppliers. And then they also funded all this development in the country over the next few years. We lost that system to there was legislation passed after that limited stopped the greenbacks from being issued. And then we went to the national banking system. It was the National Bank Act was passed during that period, and it was basically the forerunner of the Federal Reserve Act, where the private banks became the issuers of the national currency.
I mean, you write in your article that during the Civil War, with this money, Lincoln created, as you write, the greatest industrial giant the world has yet to see at that point. The steel industry, Continental Railroad was created. Farm machinery and cheap tools were promoted. Free higher education began. Government supported science. Bureau of Mines was created. You said labor productivity rose by 50 to 75%. But then the most interesting thing here, let's talk about this quote and then how you see these parallels today. And I want to encourage our listeners to join us here at 410-319-8888 or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com as we talk with Ellen Brown. Your thoughts on this, and maybe these are things none of us are thinking about perhaps, and how we begin to think differently about what to do about our country and what kind of conversation to have with our political leaders. You write that after the Revolutionary War, the London Times wrote this, and I think it's important. You write the quote from London Times in 1865, after the death of Lincoln, and they wanted to kill this monetary policy that Abraham Lincoln established. The quote was, "If that mischievous financial policy, which had its origin in the North American Republic during the late war in that country, being the Civil War, should become indurated down to a fixture, then the government will furnish its own money without cost. It will pay off its debts and be without debt. It will become prosperous beyond precedent in history of civilized governments of the world. The brains and wealth of all countries will go to North America. That government must be destroyed, or it will destroy every monarchy on the globe." And then right after Lincoln was assassinated, an historian wrote, right after the Civil War, there was a considerable talk about reviving Lincoln's brief experiment with a constitutional monetary system. Had not the European Money Trust intervened, it would have no doubt become an established institution. That's shocking.
Mm-hmm. What was exciting to me was that when Obama gave his speech at Georgetown recently,
mm-hmm.
he said people write to him, or the question he gets the most is, where is my bailout money? Why are you handing it over to these bankers? Why aren't you giving it directly to the people? And he said, what you have to understand is that banks leverage that money into 10 times that sum in loans. So if you give it to the banks, then you've created 10 times that much money. So he obviously understands the principle, which is great. And so all you have to go is one step further, and instead of trying to bail out these banks that we really can't afford to bail out because they're $62 trillion worth of credit default swaps on their books, so we have to get rid of somehow, and $165 trillion in derivatives. We can't afford to wipe all that off their books, clean them up, and use them again. What we need is to set up a public banking system.
And so why do you think there's so little discussion about this? And what would it mean if it was created?
I think they just don't realize that possibility. But if you look back historically, they're edging that way. And in fact,
what do you mean they're edging that way?
Well, Obama just said that. He obviously understands that banks create the money they lend, that they create 10 times as much money as they have. So it just takes a little expansion of thinking to see the possibility of using that principle for your own bank. Why turn to these banks that have messed up their books when you can start fresh with a bank that will pay? You can return the interest to yourself, the government, and you can fund all your projects at a very reasonable, you could fund them at 1%. That's what they did in Australia and New Zealand during the 30s. They had a publicly owned central bank, which funded development at 0.5% interest, like almost nothing. And it was money just created on the books.
Ellen Brown is joining us for this part of our program. She's an attorney practicing civil litigation in L.A., author of Web of Debt, The Shocking Truth of Our Money System and How We Can Break Free. And when I passed this article out that she wrote, that I read of Mount Carmen Dreams, it is in Yes Magazine, about not putting money into Bank of America or any other banks who are asking for it, or to Wall Street, but creating a new bank that is a federal bank that prints its own money and creates its own money and loans money in its own way. People said to me that would mean that banks at large in America and the world would go out of business. And
well,
go ahead.
Not necessarily. In India, they have public banks and private banks that operate together. In North Dakota is the only state that owns its own bank. In 1919, the farmers got tired of watching their money go to Wall Street, and they were getting foreclosed on and losing their farms, so they banded together and they passed legislation that all the state's revenues would go into a state-owned bank, the Bank of North Dakota. They are one of four solvent states right now. 46 of 50 states are insolvent. North Dakota funds student loans. They fund projects.
Go ahead, Alan. So there's some feedback on the line. We'll try to get that out. Go ahead.
Okay. And the Federal Reserve is actually moving toward doing that right now, because the Federal Reserve rebates all their profits after they collect their costs. I'm sorry, I can't talk because there's somebody else talking.
That happens here. There's some crossing on the line. I have no idea. Maybe we'll get someone in there to kind of fix it as we're talking. I apologize. When you wrote about the North Dakota Bank, which is the only bank, the only state in America that has a state-owned bank, what you wrote in there was that North Dakota has a $1.2 billion budget surplus that they made in part because of the interest they made on the money they loaned their own people.
Right. They get the profits from the credit. It's the full faith and credit of the United States, or in that case, of the people of North Dakota. It's public credit. That's all any bank does, is create credit on its books. But in North Dakota, the profits go back to the source. They go back to the people whose credit it was. And just as it did in Pennsylvania. It's a brilliant system, really. I mean, we don't have to shut down the private banks. You don't even have to oppose the private banks, but you don't have to bail them out either. Just use that same principle and do it publicly.
And it was a real eye opener, as I said, reading this article and kind of making us think in different ways. And you talk in this piece about the objection often raised is that government issued currency would lead to hyperinflation, and you argue against that point.
Well, right now we actually have deflation.
You know,
it's not even so much the banks that aren't lending; it's what's called the shadow banking system. There was all that huge amount of money that had been leveraged into like 32-1 or whatever, huge amounts of money that was funding all these off balance sheet things. In other words, banks would make loans, package them up, sell them off to investors, and then they could make more loans because they had moved them off their books. Well, now there's nobody to sell them to. So once a bank is fully loaned up, that's as far as they can go. So there's a huge amount of money that used to be flowing that isn't anymore. And so somebody needs to step in with a new credit mechanism. In other words, furnish some credit where it's been frozen. And the government could do that, and that would not create inflation. I mean, first of all, you're not really creating money. You're just creating credit. Those loans get paid back, and when the money comes back, it zeroes out.
Now, there's another quote. Your article is so full of stuff that I love to quote to people. I like to read this Thomas Edison quote, and I really want our listeners, if you can, to join us at 410-319-8888, what your thoughts are about this, about should we then say, let's not bail out the banks, let's not bail out Wall Street, let's create our own People's Bank in America, run by the government, that takes care of us and takes care of the nation as well. 410-319-8888. And here's this quote I read last week on the air from your article from Thomas Edison. And the quote is, if our nation can issue a dollar bond, it can issue a dollar bill. The element that makes the bond good makes the bill good also. The difference between the bond and the bill is that the bond lets money brokers collect twice the amount of the bond and an additional 20%, whereas the currency pays nobody but those who contribute directly in some useful way. It is absurd to say that our country can issue $30 million in bonds and not $30 million in currency. Both are promises to pay, but one promises to fatten the usurers and the other helps the people. I keep getting a little flummoxed just because I never thought about it.
And it's so logical. It's so obvious.
It's just,
think about it.
It's just bloody amazing that this conversation is not happening inside of Congress.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anybody in Congress that is talking about this, that you've heard, this particular idea?
Well, both Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, you know, have brought up the issue of the Federal Reserve.
Who was the last one you said?
Ron Paul.
Ron Paul, yes.
Mm-hmm. One wants to abolish it and the other wants to nationalize it. So they're raising the issue that the problem is the source of the money. But nobody's really talking about setting up, as far as I know, another Reconstruction Finance Corporation, in other words, another public funding institution that would create credit on its books without borrowing the money first.
Have you raised this issue with people in power, elected officials, and gotten a response?
No. Well, I just write, and people do write to me, and they go to their legislators, and I understand there are things happening in various states. In Michigan, there are people that are meeting with their legislators. Of course, Michigan is desperately broke. They need some sort of, they're ready to do something new, anything. And there's some other states that I hear are talking about it, but I haven't directly.
Well, we will.
Oh, great.
Let's open the phones here, 410-319-8888. Calvin in Baltimore, you're on the air with Ellen Brown here on the Mark Steiner Show.
Yes.
Welcome. Calvin, you're on the air. Guys, we got Calvin there? Calvin? All right, well, we'll try to get these phones happening. 410-319-8888. Join us, Calvin, try again. And we'll try to get all of you on here, 410-319-8888, or write to us. Maybe it might be easier, steinershow@gmail.com. And we'll read your thoughts on the air as we talk with Ellen Brown. Her article appeared in Yes Magazine. I discovered it in commondreams.org. And it raises an issue that most of us are not thinking about, and that maybe is a different response to where we are. And so this let's talk about the Federal Reserve for a minute and how this fits in to the Federal Reserve.
Mm-hmm. The Federal Reserve actually could be used as a tool for, it could become a public banking system even without nationalizing it. I mean, ideally, you would pass legislation. At the end of the act, I think it's the 30th chapter, whatever, it says that this act may be modified or rescinded at any time. So Congress could easily just pass legislation saying they could buy out the shareholders and nationalize it. But even without nationalizing it, it could be used as a public bank, and it is being done. That's what's being done right now, because ever since the 1960s, the Federal Reserve has rebated their profits to the government after deducting their costs. So, and the costs are basically a service charge. I'm sure it's kind of a high service charge, but anyway, they keep 15%, but so they rebate 85%. So recently, Ben Bernanke said that they were going to issue an extra $1 trillion, of which $300 billion would be for buying long-term government bonds. Well, they haven't done that before. They're basically underwriting the federal budget as opposed to merely monetizing enough bonds to provide the reserves for the banks. Normally, they have just served the banks. But now they're actually going to fund some of the government's own budget overrun, $300 billion. That what they do is they, I think the interest on long-term bonds is 3%. It's under 3%. And then they deduct 15% of that, 15. So the interest to the government is under 0.5%. It's the best deal in town.
It certainly is.
To go right to the Federal Reserve and have them fund the government projects. So what Obama could do, alternatively to having his own Reconstruction Finance Corporation, he could just go up to the Federal Reserve and say, here's my $800 billion stimulus package, or here's $800 billion in bonds. Hand me $800 billion in cash, and we'll pay you interest, and then you rebate it to us. So, and the federal debt is never paid off. It's always just rolled over. That is the central banking system. It goes back to the Bank of England. It's always just rolled over, and we only pay the interest on it. So if it was interest-free, except for a little service charge, and it's rolled over indefinitely, it's the same as creating your own money. It's a backdoor way of doing what Lincoln did.
So I also find interesting in your article that you talk about what Rolf Winkler wrote. And I went back to his article that you had. And calling the this is the greatest Ponzi scheme, that the Western economy has grown so big, there's no fixing it. So if what he's writing about, that this, who's an investment banker, that an investment advisor, that we've reached a point where we can't fix this economy, then what does it do? What good does it do even to go to our own banking system?
Exactly. We're pouring money down a black hole. So if you just forget about that system, let it go bankrupt in the ordinary way. It's not there, nowhere does it say that the government has a burden to rescue the banking system. Banks they've made a lot of money on our current system. Let them go bankrupt under our current system, like every other business does. They've taken their risks and they gambled and lost. Then put them through bankruptcy in the ordinary way. Pay off the creditors with the bank's money, not with taxpayer money.
Right.
Then, if they really are too big to fail, in other words, they're too big to, like J.P. Morgan or something that has its hooks all around the world, you can't really let that kind of bank fail. But you could take it over as a public entity after you had cleaned the books in bankruptcy.
Let's see what our listeners think. I think we have our phones hanging in here now before we have to take a break and go to our documentary filmmakers who are holding on for another conversation. 410-319-8888. Penny, you're on the air.
I think you just answered my question while I was on hold, that because you stopped the conversation a little bit on, you know, wouldn't it put the banks out of business? And my question is, in our society where we're told if you're not offering a service, then you don't go and you aren't in business. What's wrong with the bank going out of business? And I think you just answered about the bank going through bankruptcy like a normal company would, I think. Is that what you're...
Right.
My question was, what's wrong with that? And you went on to something else really quickly, and I don't know anything, but I'm just asking.
Well,
I don't even know the question, Jeff.
You know how to think logically, and I think you got to the point exactly.
Okay.
Yeah,
That's good.
Thank you very much, and I'm glad. Are you on for another whole hour, Mark?
Oh, we are another half an hour after this.
Yes. Okay, because now I get to hear you. Thank you.
Yes. Good.
Okay.
And we're on from 5 to 7 every evening now. Let's get a couple other callers in here before we talk about this documentary that will be coming up in the last part of our show here called Least of These, which is a very powerful documentary that my young daughter and I watched last night and we want to share with you. It's going to be at the Maryland Film Festival. But first, got a couple callers with Ellen Brown. 410-319-8888. Truman in Baltimore, you're on the air.
Yes, is this Mark?
Yes, it is.
Yes, Mark, I appreciate the conversation and the Brown theory. My point is that... President Obama is really taking hits now. He's giving back, I think. He's reducing taxes for like 95% of the population. He's taking hits of being a socialist. I mean, to introduce an idea like the one we have here, how would she believe that this president would be received by that?
Interesting idea. What do you think would happen if he raised this issue, Ellen?
Well, that's why... Personally, I think they are doing it, and they're doing it very quietly for that reason. Everybody will be up in arms, calling it different things, if you say that what you're going to do is just print money. But what you do is you take your bonds or debt, government debt, to the Federal Reserve, tell them to give you the cash, and then tell them to rebate the interest. Then and roll the loans over indefinitely. It's the same effect, and that's what they're actually doing. They started doing that 2 weeks ago, and they're just not talking about what it is. They're giving it new words. They're not calling it printing money. They're calling it quantitative easing. Well, it's the same thing. And who can stop them anyway? I mean, people do write all over the internet. You know, they're shocked and appalled at this and that, but. Nobody can, once they decide to do something, they do it. They just tell you what they're going to do. They don't really ask.
Well, this has been fascinating. I'll make up one more caller, Neil, before we have to go. And 410-319-8888. Mitchell, you're on the air in Randallstown.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Hi, Mitchell.
I have a question, and I'm going to be cynical, but I'm trying to understand our government and how it's giving out trillions of dollars to bail out financial institutions, automobile industry, bailing out everybody to the tune of trillions of dollars. What I want to know, as a blue collar / white collar worker, working American, why don't the government, and what would be wrong with the government giving the working class people or American citizens $1 million to help us to stimulate the economy by taking care of the various things that we need, buying cars, paying tuitions, building homes, paying mortgages. What is wrong with that idea?
I think, Ellen Brown, this is what you're saying. Your idea, the idea that you're positing for America may actually do if it was done.
Right. Well, there are two groups of money, several groups of money reformers, but that is one theory. It's called social credit, where you would actually just give the money to the people, and they would spend it and get the economy going again. But, of course, it's highly controversial, and that would be hard to get past Congress. It's easier to get past Congress the idea that you would have a program where you will fund things that will put people back to work. In other words, you'll employ people to build things. This will be good for the economy, or you'll pay for education, you'll pay for medicine, all that sort of thing. You're paying for actual things. If you just hand the money out, that first of all, it looks like you're printing money. It looks like it's going to be highly inflationary. And if you fund projects, then you can see where that money's going to come back to the government. You know, it is just a credit situation where you're lending the money or borrowing the money. That's what you're borrowing the money to build something. You employ people, pay them, they pay taxes. The taxes come back to the government. If you're building something like low-cost housing or alternative energy, the rents and fees come back to the government, so it's a circular flow. So it's just credit to create something which then pays for itself. But the question is, where do you get the credit in the first place? What we always do is we borrow from somebody that we have to pay interest to, a private bank. So the difference would be borrow from your own central bank, the Federal Reserve, or ideally the Reconstruction Finance Corporation or something that actually is government-owned. But short of that, you could borrow from the Federal Reserve, a private banking corporation, make them rebate the interest, which they do, and roll it over indefinitely. It's the same as printing money.
We have been talking with Ellen Brown, who's an attorney, but she's a writer as well as being an attorney. You can go to Yes Online and read her article, Revive Lincoln's Monetary Policy, an open letter to President Obama. It's at yesmagazine.org. And it is complete, very thought-provoking. It's an issue we're going to keep pursuing here with our elected officials and others about different ways of thinking about the future of the American economy and the future of our nation and our banking system. It's been just fascinating, Ellen Brown. I want to thank you for grabbing us by our collars and making us think in a very different way.
Oh, thank you.
It's been a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much. We're going to take a very short break. And this article will be linked on our website, steinershow.org. You can get to that and read it yourself, and let's have a dialogue about this. I'm going to be writing about it. We're going to be talking about it. I think that this is an important thing for us to begin to wrestle with. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Marcy Garriot and Clark and Jesse Lida about their film, The Least of These, which will be at the film festival. It's a very powerful, moving documentary about the power of what this country can do if it wants to change directions. We're talking about immigrants and what happens to immigrants' children, people who are being jailed, and we'll talk more about that when we return from this break. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ was formed in 1936 to help people during the Great Depression, and over 70 years later, they're still here to help people during difficult times. Go to MECU.com. We'll be right back to talk about The Least of These. Stay with us. I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome back. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by Maryland State Mortgage Late Don't Wait program. For more information and personal counseling, the number is 1-877-462-7555. Coming up on May the 5th through the 7th, May 7th through 10th, is the Maryland Film Festival. Always a wonderful, incredible event with incredible filmmakers and films coming to Baltimore. We're talking about one of those films with the filmmakers for the rest of this program. There's a film we watched last evening called The Least of These. It's a documentary made by Clark Lida and Jesse Lida. Did I say the name correctly?
Yes, you did.
Good at making sure. And Marcy Garriot, is that right too?
Yeah, Marcy Garriott.
Garriott, gotcha. I wasn't sure if it was the French or not. Marcy Garriott. And thank you all three for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
So this film, I tell you, last night we got home late and I had the film the Film Festival gave us to review, and I watched it with my 11-year-old, almost 12, should be 12 in just about less than a month, and she wouldn't go to bed. She was just stuck on this movie because she was watching people her age being imprisoned with their families, and she was just stunned by what she saw. So talk a bit, whoever wants to go first, say Clark or Jesse, about this film and the how you got into this film and what the premise is.
Well, we made the film for two reasons. One, because there are a lot of people in this country who aren't aware that our government began detaining immigrant children a couple of years ago, actually in May of 2006, which there are people who think that's a good program and people who think it's a bad program, but most people just aren't aware that it's happening and ongoing. And we also made the film to demonstrate the power of community activism. This is a case where, you know, activists were able to accomplish real change through diligent effort, and it's still an imperfect situation and about to get less perfect in August of this year, but they made a difference.
I think what really struck me was, I mean, we know that Marcy Garriott, that we know that immigrants who come into this country who are undocumented are often arrested and sent back to the countries that they come from. But this was a story about immigrants who came with children, many of them who came here not just from Latin America, but from Europe and from the Middle East and from Iraq, Iran, who are here with their children because they were fleeing something, fleeing oppression of some kind or danger, and they're in this, where they were found this, themselves in this prison in Texas.
Right, and that's, Mark, that's for me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I haven't been able to hear Clark and Jesse so far.
Oh, I'm sorry.
But yes, absolutely. Depending on what point in time, between 50% and 80% of the people in this facility are actually there seeking asylum. So they are legally in the United States following our legal procedures for seeking asylum because they have experienced some kind of insurmountable difficulty in their home country. And that's what's partly what's really troubling about this is that when they arrive at our borders, they're put into detention with their children under circumstances that many people consider still unacceptable.
And Jesse, how do you make a film like this? Let's talk about what goes into the making of a documentary like this.
Seeing that we're first-time filmmakers, you make sure you hire everyone who knows what they're doing. But, you know, we had a lot of passion behind it. And originally, this was supposed to be a 15-minute short, because mm-hmm. that's how it was presented to us. It was like a topic that was very timely. But we just kept filming. And 2 years later and 62 minutes later, here we are with this film. It was a wonderful thing for us. It really was. And we've had really good reception so far.
So, Clark, let's talk a bit about, I mean, what motivates people to do films like this. Did you and Jesse study film before this, or you just jumped into this?
No, Jesse was an actor, and I'm a reformed, recovered lawyer.
That's a long, hard road.
It certainly is. I'm still struggling to stay on the straight and narrow. But, you know, it was going to be an exercise for us. It was Marcy actually talked us into doing this. She's made several other documentaries very successfully, but she knew we were interested in film. And so she said she was busy, and she said, why don't you take this topic on and make a short? And we naively agreed. And as Jesse just said, it turned into a 2-year process. But it sucked us in very quickly. One of the first things we did was interview these families. And as I was sitting across the room from these young children who had been detained for indeterminate periods of time, you know, a month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months in a former medium security prison under really horrible conditions at that time, I became passionate about the topic.
Yeah, it was pretty infuriating, I would say, actually, seeing these children and some of them looking very, very subdued, very broken, and, you know, it's just not right, just in my opinion.
That was one of the shocking things about this film, was watching the children in this film. We're talking with Clark Lyda and Jesse Lyda, director and producers of the documentary called Least of These, which will be at the Film Festival, which is this year is set the May 7th through 9th. Their film will be shown May 8th and 9th at the Film Festival. Marcy Garriott is with us. She's producer of The Least of These. You can join us here at 410-319-8888 or write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. The film takes place in 2006. It's about the United States opening the T. Don Hutto Residential Center, a family detention center that housed immigrants and their children. But it was a private corporation that ran this for the federal government. They knew nothing, as you see in this film, about what it meant to put families in a facility like this. And it also follows the story of the immigration attorneys at the University of Texas and ACLU attorneys who fought this and actually changed what happened. It was it's a film about a fight for social justice that actually won and forced changes. And so, Marcy, so you seem to be the filmmaker of the lot here.
Right. Well, it's my third film as opposed to my first film, but I think we all learn from each other.
So they said that you brought this film to them, this idea.
Yeah, I'm actually good friends with Barbara Hines, who was one of the lead attorneys on the lawsuit that was filed against the facility.
She's in the film for the University of Texas.
Yeah, she's in the film, University of Texas, and she, together with Benita Gupta from the ACLU, filed a lawsuit in 2007, and Barbara was keeping me apprised of the whole situation pretty much from the beginning. As soon as she started getting these calls from very distressed clients in the facility saying, we're here with our children, these calls were a great surprise to Barbara because ICE had not announced that this facility would be open, so no one knew. She only found out when detainees called her clinic asking for pro bono legal support. And she had been letting me know about this, and so very early on, I did think it would make a really powerful film and that it was a very important story, but I was unable to take on the whole project by myself. And fortunately, Clark and Jesse were looking for a topic and were really the perfect directors, perfect filmmakers to take this on.
And when you approach a film like this, do you approach a film like this as social activists? Do you approach it as quote-unquote, that they like to use in the media, objective filmmakers trying to probe a subject? I mean, how do you approach a film like this?
That's a great question, and it's totally fundamental to the decision-making process on how to make a film. And Clark and Jesse, from the start on this film, said, we're only interested if we can make this a balanced film. We don't want to preach to the choir. We don't want to lecture the audience on what the right answer or the wrong answer is. We want to let everybody and all sides speak for themselves. And so that was an explicit objective of them, which I totally agree with because it makes for a much more powerful film in the end. The ironic part was it was difficult to make a balanced film in the sense that ICE refused to be interviewed. They refused to participate in the project.
ICE being
the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Organization under the Department of Homeland Security. They did not want to participate, and so we could only tell their side of the story from public news sources or press conferences, which we did. We did our best to do that, but it was frustrating that they were fairly closed on their side about the story, and therefore made our objective more difficult to meet.
Clark, Jesse, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think Marcy hit it on the head. We wanted to make a film that people who either hadn't made up their mind about this topic or perhaps were soft on either side could watch and perhaps change their mind. We're not trying to persuade the very hard writers who think that it's a perfectly fine thing to do, and we obviously don't need to persuade the people who are already convinced. So in ICE, the people who run the facility made it very difficult for us because all we could do was rely on public record, and the public record, unfortunately, is not all that persuasive on the issue. But we think in the end that the film is a very fair presentation of the arguments for and against family detention.
Yeah, I would also add to that, I think because of ICE's resistance to us, I think it's very important for these entities to have real transparency in what they're doing so that we know. I mean, it's really hard to self-regulate.
And following up on that, this facility opened in May of 2006, and the press was not allowed in the facility until 9 months later. For the very first time, and ICE, because of that lack of transparency and lack of oversight, had some really sort of egregious practices that were going on, and this film is a very good reminder of the need for transparency and oversight of government functions like this.
When you interview the families, I mean, one of the most moving parts to me was watching the women, especially who you interviewed, and the children that were interviewed, about their lives, whether it was the young Iranian boy who was a Canadian citizen whose parents were not given asylum in Canada. They ended up going back to Iran and being tortured. And his plea to be sent back to, he and his family to be sent back to Canada, or the women in that imprisonment who had been fleeing domestic abuse in Honduras or other countries that they came from, and the children sitting on those couches with this almost expressionless stillness about them, that was just haunting to me.
Yeah, it was striking, and Barbara Hines makes the point in the film that I think is very accurate, that kids have a very different sense of time from adults. And these kids, some of them were in the facility for as long as 8 or 9 months, and the parents had no idea how long they were going to be in there. And that period of time in a facility where they were, at that point in time, they were staying in 8 by 10 cells 12 hours out of the day. They were had to stay in the cell, and they were wearing prison uniforms, and they weren't going outside, and they were getting an hour of education a day. Makes for a very striking story.
Yeah, and absolutely. And plus, I would say that because of the way this particular family detention center was structured, it really undermined the role of a parent. And I think because of that, the kids were really resentful and mad at their parents.
So I want to remind people that this, we're talking about the least of these with the three filmmakers. It will be at the Maryland Film Festival, which goes from May 7th through 9th. This film will be shown on May 8th and 9th, 6:30 p.m. on May 8th and 11:30 a.m. May 9th, both at the Michael Brown Center. You can go to Maryland-FilmFest.com for more information and for tickets to come to the film festival. And we want to thank Clark Leiter, Jesse Leiter, and Marcy Garriott for joining us and for making this film. It's been a pleasure to talk to the three of you. Are you coming to Baltimore, by the way?
Yes, we are. Looking forward to it.
Look forward to meeting you and look forward to seeing you when the film is shown. Thank you so much
for making this film.
Thank you so much.
And support the film festival. Come and see this incredible series of films coming. We'll feature one every week until the film festival arrives. The Mark Steiner Show is produced by the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Jessica Phillips. We're engineered today by Ashley Boddy. Our interns are Christina Arison, Judith Lloyd, and Brian Boone, who was on the phones. Our theme music is by Walt Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again and podcast any of our past shows and hear additional interviews, visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by MECU, Baltimore's credit union, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development.